Okay, now is the morning session. I'm going to begin just as some things I'd just like to address which came up during the interviews yesterday, which I think is well worth sharing with everybody. First of all, that I never actually mentioned that when you're walking meditation, to make sure that you put your gaze about a couple of meters in front of you, keep your eyes open. Because the purpose of keeping your eyes open and putting your gaze on the floor 2 meters in front of you is... Do you want to put that close to the iPod? So it gets, can you get the sound there? Okay. Is that just to make you feel safe, that there's no obstacles in your path, but putting a gaze 2 meters in front of you, it means that you're secure from falling over things, tripping over, stepping on snakes or whatever, or banging into the wall. So you always put your keep your eyes open, gaze about 2 meters in front, and then just go walking. When you get to the end, you just mindfully stop, turn around, and go back again, keeping the eyes open for walking meditation. And again, remember those stages of walking meditation, just like the breath meditation. First of all, present moment awareness, just be here. Second, silence. Third, just being able to watch the movement of the feet, so you know it's left foot, right foot. Walking naturally, not forcing the walking. And then eventually get to like the full awareness of the feet moving. So you see the left foot from the very beginning to the end. The right foot from the very beginning to the end of the step. So your full awareness of the moving of the feet. And then the last stage will be what you might call like the beautiful walking. So just walking there, just fully aware of the feet going up and going down, walking just a happy little yogi, not wanting anything else in the world, just fully content, just watching the amazing process of walking. And that's actually how we do breath meditation. So similar to doing the... So that's how we do walking meditation. So similar to the breath meditation. All you do is just watch, first of all, present moment awareness, silence of the mind. And just watch the breath go in, go out, naturally. And see the full awareness of the breath. Beginning of an in-breath to the end of an in-breath. Beginning of out-breath to the end of the out-breath. And then to the beautiful breath. They're just watching the breath. They're just so happy. Not wanting anything in the world. Just absolutely content. With no desires, with no wants. If you can do that, then you can see the similarities between the breath meditation and the walking meditation. And the other thing which came up during the interviews, I never actually said anything yet about mantra meditation. What mantras are, just a group of words you say to yourself over and over again. You try and keep it simple. And the whole job of mantra meditation is that because it is sometimes hard to stop our thinking, and to try and actually just to let go of the thinking all in one go, we have, you know, what's called like the halfway house. So it's the middle way, middle section between thinking and not thinking at all. And that's just when we think of one thing repeatedly. So we have all these different mantras we can use. In the Thai forest tradition, they use the mantra Buddho. And they just tied it up with the breath. As you're breathing in Buddha, as you're breathing out Tho, Buddho, 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 Buddho. Time and time again. What that means is that it cuts out the rest of the thinking. You can't be thinking and just watching Buddha at the same time. So that way that, you know, you're thinking Buddha instead of thinking all these other things. And after a while, when the mind gets peaceful, you let go of Buddha as well. So you can just watch the breath without any thinking, without any words at all. So it's just like a halfway house. Just a little space in between thinking and non-thinking. We're just thinking of one thing. But there's nothing magical about any mantra. You can use your own mantra, if you like, and I think I've told many of you, my favourite mantra, which is very popular amongst Westerners, because Western people, they think so much, they're crazy with their thinking. So I tell them, instead of using Buddho, as you breathe in, you have to think, shut. As you breathe out, up. Shut, up, shut. That's a great mantra. It tells people what to do. Be quiet, shut up for goodness sake. Okay, but There's another mantra which I'm going to introduce. There's heaps of mantras, I can't go over them all. But one mantra which is a great one to use when you're walking meditation. And that mantra is, it was actually a Thai mantra. In Thai, it was, as you move your left foot, you would say, Dai. As you move your right foot, Nair. Dai, Nair, Dai, Nair, Dai, Nair. What that means in English, and people do it in English, is they move, when they're walking meditation, as they move their left foot, they think, I will die. As they move their right foot, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. Over and over again. Try it, it's great fun. What happens? It's obvious, it's the truth. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. When you start taking it seriously, you think, my goodness, that's true. And you're walking backwards and forwards, I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. And you get to, usually, most people, they get to a stage of fear. Because you think, yeah, it's obvious, but you don't really face the fact that one day you're going to die, and it could be any time. We know it intellectually, but we don't know it in our hearts. And this keeps on reminding you until it goes right into your heart. You say, yeah, that's actually true. And you get to this fear. And you go through that fear. And yeah, I will die, that's for sure. And because you keep that in your mind, all your petty attachments just fade away. What's the point of worrying about your family and your wealth and your car? What's the point of worrying about your health? You're going to die anyway. What's the point? What happens when you become completely detached? I will die, that's for sure. It means you've got nothing to worry about. You've got nothing to be concerned about. I will die, that's for sure. So it just makes you completely let go. And people who do that to the end of I will die, that's for sure, to its goal, you get so still and so peaceful, like you're floating without a care in the world. So that's a nice mantra to try and do. Walking backwards and forwards, left foot, I will die, right foot, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. It's good fun. And it actually uncovers some attachments. You get huge insights and immense peace. So maybe give that a try. This makes it a bit more interesting. If you're getting bored with your meditation, especially in the afternoon when it's hot after the meal, try that. Go backwards and forwards. I will die. Oh, that's for sure. Good fun. Okay, let's get some questions. A lot here to get to. First one, the flies swarm on our face, limbs, no matter how much of loving kindness and doors of our heart open. It doesn't work. It blocks the peace of our mind. How can you help us to solve this hindrance? Okay. Real loving kindness means you give freedom to those flies. You don't worry about them. Trouble is, the person do this with saying, flies, I'll do a deal with you. I'll give you loving kindness if you go somewhere else. And of course, that's not loving kindness, that's not letting go. But the flies will go eventually. They just leave them alone. At least they're not like the Australian flies. The Australian flies actually go up your nose. Literally. They're not afraid of you at all. And they go inside your ears and walk around inside there and explore, like exploring caves. You know, like all these caves of Ippo. That's what the cave thinks your nose and your ears are. It's a wonderful cave to explore, and they go for it. So at least the flies over here aren't that bad. They sort of only swarm on your outside. And only a little bit tickly. Because they don't harm you, they don't hurt you, they don't carry fevers, or they don't bite like mosquitoes. Just leave them alone. And if they really are troubling you, like the mosquitoes in Thailand, when we started to complain to our great teacher Ajahn Chah about the mosquitoes, he told us, okay, now the teacher, the Ajahn, is now the mosquito. Call them Ajahn mosquitoes. So if you've got flies and they're bothering you, call them Ajahn fly. They're teaching you something, because isn't that what life is like? You know, whether it's your children, your husband, your wife, your parents, or your job, or just life in general. Sometimes life, just when the wrong times, goes crawling all over you and irritating you. If you can learn from Ajahn Fly just how to tolerate just this tiny little feeling, it's not that much, it's not life threatening, how to be at peace when a fly is walking all over you, then maybe you know how to live with a husband, live with a wife, live with in-laws, and live with, you know, your friends and your enemies as well. It's learning how to tolerate the pests in life without calling the pest exterminator. So it's a great little insight practice there. If you can't do anything about it, you give loving kindness, or you say, no, fly, can you please go somewhere else? Send them to Ajahn Brahm. I've got lots of metta. You can send them to me. I'll take them all. But they won't go. They prefer you. So because of that, just allow them to be. And if you find that it's causing irritation, remember, that's a teacher. It's not the fly disturbing you. You are disturbing the fly. Just a fly being a fly, that's all. So leave it alone. So it's a great practice. At least when the flies are swarming on you, you can't get lost in sloth and torpor. You can't go dreaming off in fantasies. So at least it's keeping you awake. Good old fly. Dear Ajahn, according to the Pali Canon, did the Buddha encourage us to honour our departed relations by offering food and drink to them? To my mind, there are more meaningful ways to honour the departed ones, e.g. printing free Dharma books, radiating loving kindness to them, and doing charitable acts of transferring merits. Ajahn, what are your views? Thank you. There is only one sutta, and it's pretty debatable whether it was from the time of the Buddha or afterwards, the Buddha was going to accept a meal from the king, Bimbisara, in Magadha, in Rajagaha, and just before, the king was woken in the middle of the night, all these sounds, it was really weird sounds. And he asked the Buddha afterwards, and he said that all of your relations, they've heard, you're making this huge merit tomorrow morning, and they're outside the walls of the city, just they want to have some merit, because you're making a huge amount, they want a piece of the action. And so the Buddha actually taught King Bimbisara to actually, when you give dana like that, to also share some of the merits with departed relations. And that was the story, but it's uncertain whether that was from the time of the Buddha or just afterwards. But because of that, that's why people, when they're offering food, especially to monks or nuns, they actually dedicate the merits or dedicate the food to those departed relations. And that's like a very ancient from Buddhism. However, it's the departed beings, they don't just eat food, because these are like mind-made beings. If you just give them good karma, you don't need to give them in kind. Some people think if your relations are hungry, if you have some dream over many nights that your sort of auntie, who you love very much, comes to you and she's so thin and so hungry, thinking you have to, you know, offer some of that food to the monks. That's not correct. If you see her without any clothes, don't think you have to offer robes to a monk. Now, if you think that she's walking, she's got no place to go, don't think you have to offer a Mercedes Benz to the monks so she gets one up in heaven. It doesn't work like that. Because actually what happens is just giving something. It's like giving credit. If you give like good karma to your auntie up in heaven, then she can buy whatever she wants with that good credit. So you don't have to give in kind, just give just good karma, good metta, that's enough. And I say that because sometimes, this is actually a Thai tradition, they think that whatever they give a monk to eat, then that's the food they will eat when they get in heaven. So if they like real hot and spicy food, then that's what they give to the monk. And they don't care what the monk likes or not. They say, eat it, monk. If you don't eat it, I won't get anything when I go up to heaven. Or the same thing, they think, if you give, like if say your auntie just really likes durian, you have to give the monk durian, so your auntie gets it up in heaven. It doesn't matter what you give, it's not sort of, doesn't act like that. Whatever you give, which is from kindness, from care, then that gives like credit, if you like, to the beings up in heaven. They can buy whatever they want. So you can sort of, you know, give sort of like an English monk some bread and butter, and they get dumplings up in heaven. They don't get the same. It's just your kindness. That's all you need to give. So it is good if you print free Dharma books or radiant loving kindness or do charitable acts. That's as good, if not better, than just giving food. So if you are doing sort of acts of kindness and generosity for the departed, do it something which is useful. And the more useful, the more beneficial, then the more good karma it will be. Does that make sense? Next question. Dear Raja, we practice meditation to achieve the final goal of Nibbana, and understanding the truth, Anicca Dukkha Anatta. Can we understand this through stages when we experience Nimitta, Jhanas, or still has to go through far many different stages after that? I'm going to mention this evening when about the insights and the days afterwards when I start talking about emptiness and enlightenment. What I will actually stress this evening, that having described the path of meditation into jhanas, I'm going to say this evening how, on all stages of that path, you've had to develop insight throughout the whole stage. You may be thinking this is all just aiming at jhana, but you will only be able to get to those stages when you understand what letting go truly is, when you understand what fear is, when you understand what this doer is, when you can see what the mind is, when you can see what real letting go is. You're getting some huge insights just by walking on the path into jhanas. In fact, the deeper you go in meditation, the more subtle the attachments and the hindrances are. You can actually see that you get so deep, and then it's such a refined thing you have to do to go to the next stage. Okay, you can watch the breath, but how can you turn it into the beautiful breath? That takes huge insights, and the way you turn it into the beautiful breath is you let go of your attachment to wanting to happen quickly, your patience. You're getting some insight into what patience truly is, and what not wanting is, contentment is, freedom is. And as you go deeper, you get this beautiful nimitta. Why is it that when a nimitta comes up, people feel afraid? It's because the body is disappearing and getting some insight into your attachment to your body and your attachment to your five senses. Why can't you let these five senses disappear? Why are you always bothered about, you know, what the body's doing and always scratching it or itching it? Why can't you just let go of sound? Why have you always got to listen to the traffic? What's the traffic got to do with you? Why can't you just say, I'm going to stop listening? There's an attachment there. And once you see what's going on, you can actually understand just how that attachment stops you being still. How it keeps you carrying those burdens, which are really none of your business. And so after a while we just see, we have insight, and the result of insight, we see what the burden is, we see what the attachment is, the fetter is, we untie it, we put it down, and the thing, the problem disappears. So actually, you've been doing a heap of insight for every stage in the meditation. And to get into jhanas, you've done huge leaps of insight. And I'll be pointing them out this evening. And I keep on saying there's no difference between insight meditation and samatha meditation. It is absolutely true. And I'll explain that in more detail this evening. But you'll find that out from your own practice. So we do understand these truths of anicca, dukkha, anatta as we go all the way through. For example, just for those of you who've had nimittas, had very peaceful meditations, why are they happy? Where does that happiness come from when you get into the deep meditations? It's because dukkha, or rather a lot of dukkha, has ended. And this is actually, see what dukkha really is. It's only when the five senses and the body disappears. This is so lovely, so free, so peaceful, so beautiful. And then you actually come to understand that this body actually is a bundle of dukkha, of suffering. And these senses, to see anything, to hear anything, to feel anything, is suffering. It's much better to turn all the senses off. There's much more happiness. Once you understand what stillness of mind is, it's much more beautiful, delightful, to turn off all the senses and to listen to Beethoven. I loved Beethoven when I was a young man. Well, especially my favourite was Vivaldi. Not Vivaldi, Monteverdi, this choral singer. I don't know why that particular composer that I really loved. But better than the most beautiful, moving classical symphony is the silence of the mind when all sound completely disappears. There's absolute stillness. Better than seeing the most beautiful sunset or the most fragrant flower is the stillness of the mind when all seeing has disappeared, when all smell has vanished. Better than the most exhilarating physical feeling, please excuse me, better than sex, is just when all the senses of the body disappear. The highest ecstasy. And the reason is because you understand this body, feeling, seeing, smelling, tasting, touching, is suffering. When that degree of suffering is taken away, there is bliss. The happiness is the temporary ending of suffering. And that's a huge insight which you get to this jhana business. And to limitless. So every stage you get a heap of insight. And basically you get in one jhana, that's enough to get the final insights of enlightenment. The more jhanas you get, the more obvious it is. The first is sufficient. And I'll mention that later on. Dear Ajahn Brahm, is there such a thing as a third eye? If so, what is it? Is it just another mental perception? Thank you, Ajahn. I've got four eyes. One, two, three. So if you wear a monocle, it must be the third eye. Okay, now that third eye, that came from a book written by this so-called Tibetan monk, but he was actually an Irish plumber, it turned out to be, that Lobsang Rampa. Very fascinating. I remember seeing some of the articles when he was discovered, but nevertheless, it was a great novel. And so from this time, people always talked about the third eye as like the opening of some other way of knowing and seeing. And actually, in Buddhism, they've got so many different like words for actually the eye. They've got the eye of the Dhamma. And actually, eye of the Dhamma is actually having insight. They call it like the Dhammacakku. They say that when the eye of the Dhamma appears, as if now through your mind you actually understand what the Buddha was talking about, that's called like being a stream winner. You see the Dhamma. So that's the real, you know, the great eye, seeing the Dhamma. But it's also like this divine eye, which is very close to the idea of the third eye here. And that's why just through the power of the mind can actually see things. Already when you have like a nimitta, it is almost indistinguishable from your physical eye seeing those lights. That's what it appears like. But it's actually the mind seeing it. The sight, the eyes aren't seeing it, the mind is seeing these things. And it's a fascinating thing, once you get a strong mind, you can hear through the mind, you can feel through the mind, you can actually see through the mind. You don't have to have the physical senses. Which is actually why when people have out-of-body experiences, they're floating up above their body, and as I think Professor Pim van Lommel proved conclusively in his article in Lancet, the Journal of the British Medical Association, those out-of-body experiences, they only happen when a person is brain dead. When there's cardiac arrest and the brain is not functioning at all. So the eye, physical eye, is not working. The ears aren't working. The brain is actually temporarily dead. But they'll be able to see and hear. How can they do that? It's actually the mind seeing, the mind hearing, the mind feeling this. So actually the mind has its almost like alternative senses. It's not like the third eye, it's also the third ear. You can actually hear things through the mind. And it's that mind, when it gets very strong, when it can hear and see, that's actually where you get some of the psychic powers from. And you just look at someone, you can understand what they're thinking, what they're doing, or sometimes you know when someone's going to call you, you can feel it before the telephone rings. Oh, that's my sister. So this is actually just the power of the mind when it becomes strengthened through this stillness process. It does become like a third eye, a third ear. You can see, you can hear, but it's not seeing it through the physical eyes, It's seeing it through the mind, hearing it through the mind. That's just nature, it just happens. I'm not going to go on with that because I know people just love psychic stuff and weird stuff. Ajahn said that only pure-hearted people remain powerful in mind. Then why is the Mara still so powerful? Ajahn said that lower beings are not powerful, but my friend's friend was overpowered by a ghost and was hung to death high up an electric pole. He broke his promise to that ghost. Thanks, Sergeant. Okay, that's an interesting story. But only pure-hearted remain powerful in the mind. That's true. Obviously, your friend was not keeping precepts, was not very powerful. Because ghosts are very easy to overcome. They're just they're lower beings. They haven't got much power at all. The only power they have is to scare you. And go, ooh. And then you go running away. So listen, the next time a ghost comes to you, you turn around and go, ooh, back. And you see that ghost running off, ah! That's really good fun when you scare the ghost away. Now the point is, I don't know what happened. Overpowered by a ghost, he was hung to death high up an electric pole. I don't know how you found that out. That was the reason why he was hung to death on an electric pole. I don't know whether he told you or the ghost told you or what happened. But that sounds to me very unlikely. But I'd imagine that if he was playing around with, sometimes people do play around with black magic. The black magic, what that is that people can get some sort of deals to control the lower beings. But like most deals, eventually they sort of turn back upon the person who made the deal. And they usually have to pay for that. If you try and, it's not a ghost, it's like a lower being. They call them Buddhas. It's almost like, it's not a ghost realm, it's like the high, just above the human realm, but the lowest of the heavenly realms. There's still some they're pretty awful beings in those places. They've got power, but they've not got good minds. But they're just low-powered beings. And even human beings with five precepts can overcome those easy enough. And those beings, sometimes you control them, and sometimes they can do bad things to weak human beings. If you have kept your precepts, you're a reasonably good person, those Buddhas can't touch you. No, I told that story to someone recently. I think it may be even just on the car ride coming up here. The classic story of this was one of the disciples. I mentioned the Thai girl and the medium, didn't I, here one evening? Yeah, that Thai girl and the medium. The medium couldn't grow close to her mother because she was a Thai Mechi. She was keeping the precepts, being a good person. And even our mediums can't get close to you, let alone these ghosts and Buddhas. They just can't come close. So because of that, you can understand just when you're a good person, you are powerful, you are more powerful. As for Mara, again, Mara can only tempt you. They call him the tempter. Can't do anything. And the classic story is, the monks, they see Mara and say, I know you, Mara. I recognize you. I know what you're up to. Don't even need to do any force. Just have mindfulness, knowing. And then Mara always slinks away, head drooped. Ah, the monk knows me. The monk knows me. And the Mara just can't get close to monks who get into jhanas. That's where Mara can't go. Mara gets blindfolded because he doesn't know that realm. That's beyond Mara's experience. Because Mara's just into controlling. So this, you don't need to allow anyone to control you. Don't control yourself, completely let go. And then you're free of Mara. I say that because it's one of the sayings in the book, by opening the door of your heart. Why do you allow other people to control your happiness? They can call you a dog or a pig. Why do you allow them to upset you because of what they say? As far as I'm concerned, they can call you whatever you like. I'm not going to allow you to make me unhappy. So you can call me an idiot, a pig, a stupid old monk, too fat, you should not eat so much, Ajahn Brahm. I don't care what you say. I'm not going to allow you to upset me. I'm going to be happy despite what people say. And it's actually taking responsibility for your own happiness. When you look at it that way, you think, hey, why is it I allow so many people to make me upset? Simply because of what they say. They don't know what they're talking about. So don't allow other people to control you. When you don't allow other people to control you, then you don't allow flies to upset you. Why allow a stupid fly to make you unhappy? It's a crazy idea. And then eventually you don't allow life to control your happiness. You can get sick, you can die, everything can go wrong. Who cares? I'm going to be happy in spite of what life throws at me. Because your happiness is your own business. You don't have to react to life's uncertainties with anger and ill will. You don't have to throw away your happiness. So that's how you don't allow life to control you. You just decide to be happy no matter what. Why not? Candida, why is it that when people upset us we get unhappy? We just brainwash into reacting that way. These days, you can call whatever you like. I'm going to be happy. It's my, it's my right to be happy, no matter what you say. Okay, next question here. Moments of quietness and concentration develop when we are absorbed into the pause space between the walk, when change of steps took place. Is this right focus in doing the walking meditation? Thanks. If this moment of quietness and concentration develops, that's always good. It doesn't matter where it happens. Sometimes, you know why that happened when you were just in the space between walking and sitting? It's because when you were sitting, you were trying to be peaceful. When you were walking, you were trying to be peaceful. But when you were just going from one place to another, you weren't trying at all. And then suddenly you became peaceful. That's why sometimes people, oh, when I'm meditating, it's such hard work, but as soon as I give up, oh, it's just so nice. So why did you give up all the time? You'd see why. It's a trying. Trying to get somewhere. Trying to do something. Trying to achieve somewhere, something. Trying to get someplace. And that's one of our mistakes. And when you see that in meditation, when you see that in your walking, you're trying so hard to be peaceful. And you say, ah, what the heck, give it away. And then you are peaceful. So as soon as you stop walking, because you've stopped, then you're peaceful. As soon as you stop trying to sit meditation, then you meditate. Okay? So as soon as you stop trying, that's where meditation begins. Dear Arjuna, after going through the stages of letting go, i.e. entering and emerging from the jhanas, can one still miss to realize the Dharma if one has heard the Dharma and practiced the Noble Eightfold Path? What happened in the Devadatta's case? The Bodhisattva's teachers, Alara Kalama, Uddhaka Ramaputta, where according to the text, they have taught the Bodhisattva the state of nothingness, the state of neither perception nor non-perception. Kindly enlighten us. Okay, there's a few questions there. This is the last one, first of all. Alara Kalama, Uddhaka Ramaputta. It's, we discuss this a lot in our monastery and with other people. The Alara Kalama, Uddhaka Ramaputta, they said they taught the stage of nothingness and neither perception or non-perception. But those stages have to be based on a jhana. You can't get to those stages without going through the four jhanas. But the Buddha specifically said he didn't do the jhanas with those teachers. The only other time he did the jhana was under the rose apple tree when he was a kid. So the solution to that paradox, and it's an obvious one when you think about it, is what Alara Kalama Uddhaka Ramaputta taught were not the real thing. It wasn't the real stage of nothingness, not the immaterial attainment. It wasn't the real stage of neither perception or non-perception. Because those stages are so profound, they actually do lead to enlightenment. And the reason is because what actually happens, and you can see this even today, that when you start talking about, say, like jhanas, sometimes people realize, oh yeah, jhanas are really important. And you can see yesterday the way I taught the jhanas, how I explained them. And other people, they don't explain it with such a high standard. I know that some people say if you get a little bit of happiness and peace, a little bit of less pity sukha, that's the first jhana. But when Ajahn Brahm taught, it's huge, it's very, very high. And the point is that a lot of teachers would always lower the standards, just like in universities these days. Now, you know, when I did a university degree, it's very difficult to pass. These days, anyone can pass. In fact, these days, you can just go to the United States and just pay a few $100s. You get your degree straight away. You don't even need to do any exams. And it's always the case, actually, the standards lower and lower and lower and lower. I did read this. I couldn't believe it. There was an article earlier this year. Apparently, in Italy, anyone who gets a bachelor's degree is called a doctor. Before, you had to get a PhD to be a doctor. Now, anyone, if you get a BA, you can always call yourself doctor. And it's also, I don't know if any of you have done your history, in Europe, in the Middle Ages, if you ever read Goethe's Dr. Faustus, that this guy Faust, he was actually given his PhD, his doctorate. And these universities in the Middle Ages, they would only give one doctorate, maybe every 5 or 10 years at most, just one. And to get that doctorate, you had to be very, very special. Imagine a university only give one PhD every 10 years to one student. That means that, you know, in those days, to be a doctor, you were really brilliant. But how many people have got PhDs these days? The universities, they churn them out, churn. So actually the level has gone down quite considerably, and it will always continue going down. It's just the nature of human beings to lower the standards. It's the same with the stage of nothingness and neither perception nor non-perception. In the time since the previous Buddha Kassapa, the level of those attainments, or what was supposed to be those attainments, got so reduced that what the Buddha did was not the real thing. For Devadatta, it is very likely that Devadatta got the jhanas and got some psychic powers, but he missed the point because of his pride, because of the ego. Usually, if you look at the jhana afterwards with wisdom, you see the only way you can get in there is actually by lessening your ego, by abandoning the sense of self, by not doing things. However, there is always the danger that once you get these huge states of mind, it's very easy to think you're enlightened, to think that you've made it. Because there you have a huge, powerful experience, and for days afterwards, sometimes you can't see any hindrance left at all. No greed, no hatred, no delusion. It's very easy, and I'll mention this in the talk on enlightenment, anyone with a jhana to think they're enlightened. That's one of the dangers. It's just a powerful experience. It's not enlightenment, because later on the defilements will come up. And if you are honest to yourself, you see a defilement like pride or greed or lust or anger coming up, you realize, yeah, that was a great experience, but you've still got some hindrances left. It's only through the insights after jhana those defilements are fully abandoned. But they're really suppressed through the jhana. So it's quite likely, and sometimes it does happen, that people think they're fully enlightened after the jhanas. Remember this one monk, when I was a young monk in with Ajahn Chah, he obviously got some very deep jhanas, and then he developed the divine ear. In the monastery in Wat Phra Phom, he was about 6-8 kilometers from the market, he could hear everything which was going on in the local market. He could tell the supporters afterwards exactly what they said. He developed this incredible divine ear to be able to hear sounds a long way away. Unfortunately, with the psychic powers and with the deep meditation, he thought he was enlightened. And one day he sat in Ajahn Chah's chair and started teaching Dhamma. And Ajahn Chah was obviously very skillful. He pointed out just why this monk, he got in a huge state of mind, very good, but wasn't fully enlightened. And to give this monk credit, because he had faith in Ajahn Chah, he realized his mistake. And I think the next morning, just out of humility, because he realized it was pride, he went in the dining hall, and he, at the foot of every monk in that dining hall, maybe about 60 monks, he bowed and asked forgiveness of each monk in turn. Great humility. Because he realized he made a mistake. Now that's a good monk. They make a mistake, but they're willing to say sorry. And he realized it's just the power of the meditation can do things like that to you. With Devadatta, he was just too proud to realize his mistake. Not even the Buddha could tell him that he was mistaken. He thought that he was the Buddha's equal. It can sometimes happen. You get the jhanas and you know some dharma, but the two don't come together and the enlightenment doesn't happen. But if you don't have the jhanas, it won't happen. If you don't have the insight or don't have the wisdom, it won't happen. The two together are important. And the chances are you have those two again and again and again. The jhanas, you have the teachings of the Buddha, the two together, sooner or later, the flame is going to meet the gunpowder and things are going to go bang. And I'll talk about that and then I'll talk about enlightenment in a couple of days. May I ask whether all the Buddhas, Arahats, who have Siddha, Samadhi, Panya and perfection have unique different tendencies and behaviour? Yeah, they all have different tendencies and behaviour, simply because of where they came from. Now there were some monks who were very, very strict, like Mahakasapa. Now he was a very, very tough monk, very, very strict on himself. There's other monks like Venal Sariputta, who was just so kind and compassionate. He'd do anything for anybody. There's this one story in the Losika Jataka. There was this monk who would never get enough to eat. It's because of some karma from his past. And when Sariputta found out about this monk, every day he went hungry. He never starved, but he never got enough to eat. He said, right, I'm going to get this monk a good meal today. So he said, come with me. Follow me on my arms now. And I've got all my disciples, because Sariputta, a very famous monk, and said, now they're going to give me something and I'll give you half. And so he decided to give this monk, this Losika, a really good meal, at least for once in his life. So, Losika followed behind, and all Sariputta's disciples, they sort of put heaps and heaps of food in Sariputta's bowl. Sariputta said, give the rest of the monk behind. For some reason, they just couldn't do it, and they didn't do it. And so after going on arms out, Sariputta's bowl was heaped with delicious food. And he looked around, expecting the monk behind him to have the same. This bowl was empty. My goodness, that's no good. And so he said, here you go. And he tipped all his food into the monk's bowl. And as he tipped it in, it all vanished. He thought, my goodness, this is some really bad karma. And even I'm giving my own food to you, and it all vanishes. So he said, never mind, I'm still determined. I'm going to get you a good meal. So by this time, the time for alms round was over. So he decided to go into town and get all these medicines. Like the honey and the ghee and the sugar. He said, at least I can get that for you. So he went around all his supporters getting all these medicines. And when his bowl was full of these medicines, I'm going to get this monk a good meal with all these medicines. He went back to the monastery and found out that the time he was getting all these medicines, that monk had died. So that even with the best kindness, Sariputta just could not give this monk a good meal because it was his karma. The karmic force was too strong. So this Sariputta, he just went out on a limb to try and help others. He was just such a kind and compassionate monk. So it was his nature. Ananda was just this very, very softy. It was just any lay person who came to ask anything, he'd say yes, yes, yes. Whenever they would ask just one more question, he'd say yes, yes, yes. He would never turn anybody away. And they asked, can you come back for another retreat? He'd always say, yes, yes, yes. He would never say no. He's just such a wonderful kind. So he got all these different sort of, and some people like Aniruddha, he was just, this ascetic. He never said a word to anybody. He was just always meditating off in the jungles, in the caves. This hermit monk. So there are all these different monks with different characters. And it was quite nice to see that they don't always have to be the same. And have all these nuns as well. These very powerful teachers. These remote people. These aloof arahats. It's marvellous to see the different types of characters. Does Buddhism condone euthanasia? Thank you. Yet we want to do euthanasia properly. It's called parinibbana. The real proper death. You kill yourself, commit suicide or euthanize. And what happens? You come back again. You haven't done it properly, for goodness sake. So this time, to do it once and for all, have done with it. So when you go to jhanas, you get these great insights, all your defilements are gone, this is my last life, you can say to yourself. And that's the best euthanasia, this is my last life. So when you go and never come back. So I can't go into that in briefly. Maybe I did mention this last night, maybe I will go over this. Euthanasia, or I mentioned this last night in brief. I thought somebody might pick me up on this, because I said that, well, sometimes somebody might be in a coma and there's no hope and they may last. So should you turn off the machine? Or should you keep them going just in case? What should you do? What happens? You may have like a pet, like a dog or a cat. You take it to the vet and they say, that's got very painful cancer. It needs to be put down. What should you do? Should you tell the vet to kill your pet? Or should you take it home and let it suffer in agony? What should you do? The standard answer which I give these days is that if your cat has got, say, a bad cancer, it's broken its legs in great pain, and you have to make that decision, just stop calling it putting the dog down, it's killing it, or not killing it. You should ask the dog. Ask the dog what it wants to do. And by that I mean, if that's your pet, your dog, your cat, if you just ask it that question and make your mind still and peaceful, you should know what the dog wants. Whether it's had enough, or whether it still wants to live. Because you can't assess another person's pain, whether they still want to carry on, or whether they want to let go. You can't do that. Because sometimes people are in great agony, but they still want to carry on. Sometimes, you know, it's not that great pain, but they can't stand it. People's tolerance levels are just so unique. So I tell people, if you've got a cat and it's dying, ask the cat what it wants. Make your mind still and peaceful, and you will know almost immediately what the right answer is. You say, no, my cat wants to live. You can feel it. I say that with cats and dogs. That's also the best advice. If you've got a loved one, husband, a father, a mother, a grandparent, who's in the ICU, and the doctors say, there's no hope of recovery. And you have to make that decision. And it is your decision. It's not theoretical, not just something you discuss in a Buddhist center. It's real. It's costing you thousands of dollars a day, taking up another bed for somebody else. Focusing your whole life on your parents. Are they dead or are they alive? What should you do? If that happens to you, and you're in that situation, the best advice I can give you, make your mind very, very peaceful and quiet, and listen, and ask your mother, say, are you dead? Do you want to carry on? Ask the question. And if you've done a little bit of meditation and you are a tiny bit sensitive, you'll feel the answer. No, she's still there. There's still a chance. She wants to keep trying. No, keep the respirator on. Sometimes you'll feel, no, she's already gone. There's no one left. It's just a body. And if that's the answer, you say, turn the respirator off. You're not killing anybody. The person's already gone to the next birth. They've already left. Just the empty shell. It's hard to know for sure. But if you're the close relation, if that's your loved one there, you can trust the answer as long as you ask first. And that is one of the best ways. It's practical, it works, and it solves the problem. And is it euthanasia? Because once that stream of consciousness has left the body, it's not a being anymore. It's just the body just being kept alive, just being kept going by artificial machines. But if the stream of consciousness is still in there, yeah, I mean, it's still a possibility of survival. Somehow you've got to know whether your mum, your father is still in there or not. And the only way to know is to ask. Okay? So that's a very practical piece of advice which I've been teaching people a long time now, and it works very well. It solves a lot of problems. If one kills by accident, does he create bad karma? Or this itself is bad karma? Though by accident, will the kill being remember the killer? Some say Tibetan Buddhism is higher Buddhism, its secrets unrevealed. Please comment. A Tibetan guru claims himself to be living Maitreya Buddha. Please comment. What is the reason people can't find faith in the Dharma? Truth. Thank you. Lots of questions there. If a kill being by accident, does it create bad karma? If it really is by accident, there's no karma there. Karma has to be intentional killing. Nevertheless, it's still unskillful. There's no bad karma there. We should be a bit more careful, you know, with the other animals and beings which you share this planet with. So there's no bad karma, so don't feel guilty. But you can say, oh, you know, I was a bit heedless there. I should be a bit more careful. Watch where I'm going so I don't step on those snails. And then it's not bad karma. I know this one time, I didn't actually kill this snake. But what actually happened one morning, because I'd been meditating all night in this monastery in Thailand, I went up to out of the hall just to urinate. And as I was urinating in the forest, I thought I was peeing on a stick. But then the stick started to move. And I realized I'd peed on a snake. And it's also one of the most sensitive parts of my anatomy. It was only just a few inches from its mouth. It's a very dangerous situation. All you males can understand. But the snake, it didn't bite me. It seemed to be quite happy. I thought perhaps because it thought it was holy water. At the time I peed on a snake. So I said my forgiveness and it left me alone. So was that bad karma? Well, good karma. I don't know. There was no intention there at all. But afterwards I was very careful for the next couple of months where I peed. So if you've actually had an accident and you've killed another being, then be more careful next time. And some say Tibetan Buddhism is higher Buddhism. You know, when anybody says that they've got the highest Buddhism, I always realize they're just judging, they're comparing, they don't know what they're talking about. Higher and lower, bigger and smaller, that's all ego. So if Ajahn Brahm comes up along and says, I've got the highest Buddhism, then don't believe me. Anyone who says they're the best, you can actually tell them they're just that pride, egocentric. So it's not, Tibetan Buddhism is good. Vajrayana is good. Theravada is good. Mahayana is good. Zen is good. None is higher or lower. But people say that just because they want to get more disciples. Actually, I say that this Buddhism is the lowest Buddhism, because I want to get rid of disciples. I'm trying my hardest. With secrets unrevealed, the Buddha actually said, he made this great sutta, he said, I do not keep the teacher's closed fist. I've revealed everything which needs to be revealed to you. This is an important saying. He said, whatever is needed, I have revealed. He said, I wouldn't go to Parinibbana, I wouldn't leave, if there was some secret unrevealed. But number two, he did actually say, and some people quote this, he took a leaf, took a handful of leaves in this Simsapa forest. And he said, monks, which are more, the leaves in my hand or the leaves in the forest? He said, well, of course, the leaves in the forest are much more than the leaves in your hand. He said, in the same way, monks, what I've revealed to you compared to what I haven't taught you is just this amount of leaves in my hand compared to all the leaves in the forest. And some people actually say that to say, oh, there's lots of secret teachings. But then the Buddha said, the reason why I haven't taught these other things is because they're completely useless, they've got nothing to do with meditation, they've got nothing to do with enlightenment, they're not helpful to the path. That's why I haven't taught them. What is useful to the path, what is helpful, I've taught the lot. That's actually the saying of the Buddha. So there are no secret teachings. All those teachings are right there for each one of you. If anyone starts to say secret teachings or better Buddhism, they are con monks. I wouldn't actually believe them at all. A Tibetan guru claims himself to be the living Maitreya Buddha. My goodness. Please comment. Okay, the Maitreya Buddha cannot come You probably find out he gets angry, he looks after donations. If it's a Buddha, they've got no anger, no greed, no lust, they're selfless, completely selfless and completely pure in all their actions of body, speech and mind. So just, if anybody says that, test them out. If they're Maitreya, Maitreya means like loving kindness. You say, you know, can please loan me 1,000 ringgit, please. If he says, no, he said, why not? You've got compassion, selfless. Please, give me 1,000 ringgit. Okay, next question. Is it true that when one passes away while in the jhanas, one will be reborn in the arupa realms? If that is true, then one will be there for a long, long time and may miss the next Buddha. Do we have to be reborn in the human plane to attain nirvana? A lot of questions with each piece of paper here. When one passes away in the jhanas, if it's the four jhanas, one gets reborn in the rupa loka, not arupa. If it's in the immaterial jhanas, one will get reborn in the immaterial realms. However, this is a fascinating. If you're a screen winner, you see in the Dhamma, and you die in the jhana, you get this automatic promotion to be an anagami, a non-returner. A screen winner who dies in jhana becomes a non-returner. They go to those rupa realms or arupa realms for eon after eon. When they pass away from there, they just parinibbana. They never come back. It's a beautiful way to go out. The reason is because the last thing you see in the Dhamma, attachment to the body is all gone. So you just disappear into Nibbana. So if you have not a stream winner and you get the jhanas, doesn't matter when you get reborn, if there's no Buddha around, you probably become a Pajaka Buddha. Because you're so close to Nibbana, you probably see it for yourself. And certainly you'll be a great being when you get reborn into this realm. So you don't need a Buddha around, you've already got enough momentum. You probably see the Dharma very easily. It's a Pachaka Buddha. That's a Buddha who just becomes enlightened from the time when there's no Buddhas around and just doesn't teach. Does one have to be reborn in the human plane to attain Nibbana? No. You can get Nibbana in many other planes. Sometimes people say that, but if you look at the suttas, what the Buddha said, that sometimes the Buddha would give a teaching, give some Dharma teaching. And sometimes, not just human beings, but devas would be listening. And many people would become, many devas would become stream winners, anagamis, non-returners, or fall enlightened by listening to the Buddha teaching. So even devas can get insight by listening to the Buddha's teachings. That's in the suttas. The point is that this is the best realm. More people gain stages of enlightenment in the human realm than in the other realms, but it's still possible. You've got to invite the devas in, well, come on you guys, listen. And they get inspired, they see the Dhamma, and then they become enlightened. That happens. So again, one of my favorite stories in the suttas, there was this lady, very devout Buddhist, and one day these two monks arrived just before the rains retreat, before Wassa, and she said, oh monks, please come and stay close to my village. It's a lovely place to meditate, just by the river. I get my husband to build you a couple of huts. I promise I will feed you every day. I'll even wash your robes for you. And the monk said, yeah, sadhu, sadhu, we'll do that. So these two monks, they had this wonderful hermitage by the river for the whole 3 months rains retreat. And this lady, she was a devout Buddhist. She didn't have any time to meditate herself. She was doing her household chores and then cooking this amazing food for these monks. She had so much faith. Washing their robes, doing everything for them. Whatever the monks needed, she would do it. And then later on, sort of after the rains retreat, much later on, when everybody was dead, she got reborn in the Tawatinsa realm, which is in a very nice high realm of gods. And then she decided, I wonder where those monks are, who I looked after. And to her great disappointment, she found that those two monks had actually been reborn in a lower realm, and they were a couple lower than she was. And she was very mad at them. So she went to scold them. Said, monks, I was cooking, cleaning, working myself, my fingers to the bone for you two scallywags. And look, I'm in the Tawatinsa realm. You've hardly got anywhere at all. What the heck were you doing, you lazy, no good monks? And she scolded those two monks in this heaven. And then one of the monks, you know, this interesting word, they said, he aroused mindfulness. Or rather, he established mindfulness. Mindfulness is not just being aware, but it's also remembering. He remembered all those teachings, and he was aware. And at that moment, sort of, he got a stage of enlightenment and went up to something, the Anagami realm. Her scolding did the point. He'd had all those teachings before in the life as a monk, but he hadn't really penetrated them. He was too lazy. And that scolding really sort of brought into his senses. He thought about those teachings, and enlightenment happened. As for the other monk, he was proud, just a woman, he thought, get away. And he just carried on, just in that lower realm. But now this is what happened. You can become enlightened in those, in the heavenly realms. Dhirajan, can contentment alone uproot greed, hate, and delusion in the practice towards enlightenment? Yes. Contentment is the most powerful of the attitudes of mind. It's a type of letting go. And it's incredible what you can do with contentment. No matter what situation you're in, you just give it contentment. Okay, this is good enough. And you maintain that contentment. The thing is, you've got to sustain it, maintain it for long periods of time. And that contentment, it just builds up its power. Because you're content, you don't move, you're still. And peace just grows and grows and grows. You don't want anything. You don't need anything. Now why do people strive so much? Because they want to get to this place where they can rest, where they can be content. All craving, all struggle is to try and get to a place of contentment. We can relax and take it easy and live happy ever after. So, you can do that now. Live happy ever after now. You have enough. How much do you need to be content? You've got more than enough. I don't want any more. This is good enough. I have to be careful of that, like as a monk, like as an abbot. How many monasteries do you need? You know that what some monks, they've always got projects going on. I confess, I've got a meditation retreat center, but I don't care if that's never built. Whenever it's built, that's fine. But I'm completely content if nothing happens. In your house, have you got a big enough house yet? Over in the West, it's crazy. They get a house, as a big house, there's only two or three people. You know how many rooms they have? Everyone lives in a mansion, they don't live in a house these days. And as soon as they paid off their mortgage, their bank loan, they either sell the house and get a bigger one, or they put on extensions. Extension after extension. And they're never satisfied, never content. How many rooms can you stay in one time? Only one. So when you're content, you don't need that much. You don't need that much, you've got more time. Now you women, how many shoes do you need? Since 2000 somebody suggested. When you're content, this is good enough. No one looks at your shoes anyway. Only you do. So, you can be content with it. When you're content, you're just so free. Especially when you're young. What do you look like? Are you pretty or ugly? Who cares? I'm happy with myself. You be content. Otherwise, especially ladies these days, have to do these extreme makeovers. Because they're never content. Even these film stars, they're already beautiful enough, they still have to have extreme makeovers. Oh, just what a pain. So contentment gives you freedom. Yeah, content who you are. It doesn't matter if you're ugly or you're pretty, you're just who you are, for goodness sake. It doesn't matter whether you can meditate or you can't meditate, you're good enough. So be content. It doesn't matter if you're wise or you're not wise, if you think too much or you don't think enough, be content. Have the guts to be content. If you have to be content, you find that that is the fastest path to Nirvana. It's just so easy. We make it hard. We struggle too much. All struggling is craving, desire, wanting, not wanting, ill will towards yourself. You slept too much last night. You stupid me. Bang, bang. You're not content with yourself. You know, if you did sleep a lot last night, you know why? cause and effect, nature. It's nothing to do with you. Just the five khandhas, that's all. It's what five khandhas do. When they're tired, they sleep. So I want to be content. It's just five khandhas, nothing to do with me. Somebody else's problem. They just sit there, happy, before they sleep, that's fine. Seem to be absolutely content. No desire at all. No will. Then the whole of the universe stops. If you're content, the whole of the universe is content with you. And then the Buddha smiles. Okay? That's a great question. Contentment takes you all the way. Next question. I keep the 8 precepts during the full and new moon days of each month. For this retreat, I now know the 8 precepts can take cheese. Since cheese is hard and solid stuff, is that not considered taking food after midday? What are the other allowable solid food that can be eaten? Okay. Some monks say that cheese is allowable, some monks say it isn't. So there's always these arguments about what goes in the mouth. And as I've mentioned before, what goes in the mouth is not so important as what comes out of your mouth. So you make sure that's pure first, and then what goes in the mouth is secondary. So it's just our tradition. It doesn't make any sense to me either. Where you draw a line, why is it just 1 inch south is Malaysia, 1 inch north is Thailand? What's the difference? If you've ever been to the border, I can't see any line in there. I know on the atlases, Malaysia is one colour, Thailand's another colour. But when I look, I can't see different colours on the ground. So, you know, all this, you know, where you draw the lines, it's always arbitrary. So there's a line drawn, it's somewhere cheese is either on one side or the other. Monks can't decide what. So out of compassion, because it's retreat time, because many of you aren't used to keeping the 8 precepts, because I'm just really soft and compassionate, just have some cheese. The same as like soy milk. You know, the Ajahn Chah said, no, you can't have soy milk or any other milk. But next retreat, other monks say you can, so go for it. You have some soy milk or some milk. It's only a tiny thing. And if that helps you meditate and keeps your stomach happy, fine. So, to go into the technicalities, you have to be a monk lawyer. So, we'll leave that one. It has been said that only peppers will benefit from the merits that we transfer. Why is it that we still chant sharing the merits with the devas and celestial beings? The Akasata Bhumata, because they do rejoice as well. If your mum was a deva and she saw you keeping 8 precepts, listening to Dhamma, offering food to the monk, meditating, oh, she would be so happy with you. And that's my daughter over there. And she's meditating. She's doing dana. She'd be so happy. Same as it might be your father or your mother, grandmother. And so, you know, you're a Buddhist, you're doing a good job, you're supporting monasteries, you know, you're giving dana, you're keeping precepts. Oh, your mother and father would be so proud of you. And so when they see you doing this, they get huge amounts of energy and happiness. That's how the merits have been transferred. What you're doing, they say, Mom, Dad, come and have a look. And they say, ah, that's my son. That's my son. Look what he's doing. Ah. So they get a lot of happiness. So that's how merits can be transferred. One last question. I was about to ask you about any particular chant or sutta to ask the bees who have nested in my kitchen roof to move elsewhere. And I noticed that all the flies were absent this morning. Did you do a special chant for this to happen? I think they went somewhere. I think they went to somewhere else. Somebody else. So no, because I think it was just, you know, the flies like everybody else are lazy. They don't get up that early in the morning. So they're all sleeping this morning. Okay. I've got some other questions left, so please, you know, it's 9:15, please don't put any more questions in the box today. We've got enough here for tomorrow as well, so I'll put those in there for tomorrow, and these are the ones I've answered today. So hopefully you've enjoyed some of those questions and some of the answers, more important than questions. Thank you again for asking them. Now please carry on meditating, be just so content, just completely let go of all craving. Allow yourself to float through every moment of the day. Not fighting a bit. You just sit there and just enjoy this moment. This is so nice. At last I don't have anything to do. All my jobs are complete. All my tasks are finished. Don't have to get anywhere, do anything, change anything. This is perfect as it is. If you think it's imperfect, remember the simile of the brick wall and the two bad bricks. You're just looking at the two bad bricks. You've just done so much already. You're such a perfect, beautiful person. Isn't that good enough? So allow this moment to be just full of absolute 100% contentment. It doesn't matter what happens next. Just what's happening now is all you need to worry about. Just be content with this. And then you'll be enlightened before lunch. If you're enlightened before lunch, let me know and we'll get a cake. Okay, interview time now.